Welcome to the latest edition of Wax Ecstatic. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. As always, I appreciate you joining me as we continue our deep dive through the big old binder of baseball cards from the 1960s now. And we're looking at one of my favorite sets from the 1960s. It's not one of the best sets of the 1960s. It's not one of the best sets in the history of Topps baseball cards. However, the 1968 set is very unique. It has two incredible rookie cards that have carried it for many, many years. And it is an important piece in the history of not only the sport of baseball, but in the United States, as we are going through our own chapter of politically based thrashings and emotional outburst over right versus left, this party versus that party. Well, 1968 was a predecessor to what we've experienced in 2017, and you could argue 2016, as the country was coming apart at the seams back then, but baseball in many ways kept it all together. And we'll talk a little bit about the historical background of 1968 and the 1968 top set, as we also talk about the random poll, a very interesting player, a player who was once touted as the best amateur player coming out of Cincinnati, Ohio, even more talented than his teammate, one Pete Rose. Ed Brinkman, seen here in his days with the Washington Senators, card number 49 in the 598 card 68 top set. We'll talk a little bit about Ed Brinkman, and I don't want to knock Ed, the late Ed Brinkman. He passed away back in 2008. He actually had a very, very serviceable career, was in the major leagues for about 15 years. But, you know, when you're right up there with Pete Rose and you're given a little more money and you're touted a little more than a Hall of Famer with an asterisk next to it, it's very similar to the arguments that you hear nowadays of Derek Jeter and Chad Mottola. You know, you look at the teams that drafted before the Yankees did in 1992, taking somebody other than Derek Jeter. And, you know, there's always coulda, woulda, shoulda with any professional sports draft. You know, look at the NFL 1998. What if the Chargers took Peyton Manning as opposed to Ryan Leaf? Well, the Chargers may be in San Diego now, not on their way to Los Angeles. You can talk about, you know, in hockey, what if the Minnesota North Stars took Steve Yzerman instead of Brian Lawton? You know, there's all sorts of shoulda, woulda, couldas in drafts. Well, pre-draft in Major League Baseball, I'm sure there are a lot of teams that are kicking, going after Pete Rose as opposed to other players. But, you know, with that said, Ed Brinkman had a pretty interesting career, was on the winning side of a lopsided trade involving the Washington Senators. And, of course, the Senators were just, you know, an absolute mess for much of their existence their second time around in Washington in the 1960s and into the early 1970s. So we've got plenty to talk about there. And plenty to talk about from our Twitter feed at Wax and Gum Stains. Plenty of conversations going on. I can't get to them all, but thanks to all those who did chime in this past week on numerous topics. And we'll start off actually with a tweet that we sent out, and it's something I discussed in the last podcast. I said that I was just kicking around this idea where I would find some vintage cards, unopened products, you know, we're talking wax packs or rack packs, cello packs, whatever. And what I would do is probably once a week, because I only have so much time to do this, but it seems like it's something that could be fun. But probably once a week, we'll find something that we'll put up and auction off, basically. We'll give our entire audience 24, maybe 48 hours just to, you know, look over the product and then decide if you want to bid. And through direct messaging through Twitter, you can place your bids. And then the winning bidder, we will do a special video breaking of that product. We'll open it up. We'll take a look at the cards, talk about the particular cards that are in there. Hopefully you land a big one. And then what we'll do is we'll package it back up and then send it out to the winning bidder. So we'll do, it's not a live break, but we will do a video break and have some fun opening up some old product there. So that's something that we are going to start doing, if not this week, maybe next week. But I did get some pretty positive responses back to that idea. Nobody came out and said, this is really dumb and a waste of time. I don't care. I wouldn't say it was an overwhelming positive response, but for the most part, the responses we got, people were pretty enthusiastic about it. So if doing video breaks is your thing, then pay attention and make sure you're following us on Twitter at Wax and Gum Stains, because that is something that we will do. Like I said, I might be able to do it this week. Kind of got a busy week at work and in my personal life. But if we don't get it this week, we'll get it going next week. But I believe we should make the first product that I put up for bid, because I already have it at home. It's ready to go. We will put up a rack pack of 81 tops. Not just a rack pack. It's one of the grocery packs from 81 tops. And I've had a couple sitting around in my house for years, and they've just been sitting there. So we'll take one of them, put them up for bids, and then open them up. So that will be the item. When exactly we do it, I don't know. But make sure you pay attention to Wax and Gum Stains to see when we put that item up there. Now, speaking of opening up some old product, Kyle Benning, who was with us last week, we were making fun of his dreaded manager card, the Dallas Green 89 Tops Rediscover Tops card that he got, the buyback card. And by the way, I can confirm, my memory was a little hazy when I was trying to reach back into all the Yankees managers. Yes, Dallas Green did not finished the season. Bucky Dent was the manager of the Yankees for much of the 89 season, and he was going to be replaced by Billy Martin in the 1990 season, but Martin died in a car crash on Christmas Day in 1989. Speaking of Billy Martin, and I like sharing baseball or sports books with our listeners, I just finished the autobiography of Billy Martin, which was co-written by Peter Golenbach. It was written back in 1980. And that's a fun book to read if you can track it down. I bought it used at our local library. So I don't always read baseball books, but when I do, I like to pass them along to you. So if you're a fan of Billy Ball, then check out. It's called Number One, the Billy Martin Autobiography with Peter Golenbach from 1980. But anyways, Kyle, you know, we were making fun of him for pulling that 89 tops Dallas Green manager buyback card. Well, he shared a nice little find. I snagged a cheap box of 89 Donruss today. Looking forward to opening a few packs tonight. Well, Kyle, I hope you at least got a few worthy cards. Maybe you pulled a Ken Griffey Jr. out of it. Again, 89 Donruss, because it's right in the heart of the junk wax era, as it is called. You're not going to get too many extremely valuable cards in terms of dollars and cents. In fact, probably only four or five cards from that set are worth a dollar or more. But you get to rip through an old set. You get to find some old stars, some of your favorite players from when you were a kid. And also, more importantly, it's just a fun thing to do. And 89 Donruss is a nice set. It's one of those sets because it followed the redheaded stepchild of the junk wax era, that, of course, being 88 Donruss. 89 Donruss doesn't quite get the love that it deserves. It's actually a very nice looking set. And if you have the time, check out our podcast from 89 Donruss from a few months back. Our random poll was Red Ass Kevin Brown. But I give lots of love to 89 Donruss. It's a great set. And even though, you know, financially, I mean, you probably bought that box for, I don't know, $7, $8. You're probably not going to get $7 or $8 worth of big name cards out of it, but I'm sure it was a fun experience for you, so I hope you enjoyed it. Now, 67 Tops, that was our feature product in the previous podcast, Boog Pal, our random poll. And I had asked the question going into the podcast, well, why do people love 67 Tops so much? Is it a work of art, as some people will claim, or is it just a boring set? And my take on it was that it's a good set, but not a great set. And again, coming off of some of the really nice sets that Topps put out earlier in the decade, 67 Topps, it's lacking a little. There are some good things about it, but some not so good things. And Cardboard Clubhouse would chime in. Not one of my favorites. Always found it very bland. And I agree with that. Bland is a good word. You know, there's some positives to it, but you don't just jump out of your seat and go, wow, it's 67 Topps. Now, at the other end of the spectrum, Sleep Frank, our buddy from San Diego, says, I dig this set. The green has a feeling of nostalgia. Apparently, he has two sets. My uncle's The Boyer Brothers, Gramps, got them for me. Well, good for you for having those sets there, Frank. And I will say the green does have a feeling of nostalgia. As I joked in that podcast, everybody who grew up in the 60s or 70s, especially, you had that dishwasher, that refrigerator, that shag carpet that was that avocado green that was featured so prominently on the back of the 67 Topps cards and made those cards so difficult to read. It was kind of hard to read the black text on the dark green background. And as I mentioned, too, collectors aren't big fans of that dark green because the wear and tear that those 50-year-old cards have had shows up a lot easier on a dark green background as opposed to a card, let's say, if it had a white border on the background with white cardstock and a dark green background, then perhaps collectors would like it a little more because it wouldn't show the wear and tear as easily as it does. Another person that's on my side of the battle here, CompleteYourSets.com, you're not alone. The 67 cards are vastly overrated. Well, I wouldn't say vastly overrated, but I've just never been on that side of the aisle that says this is a great set. Like I said, it's a good set, but not something that's outstanding by any stretch of the imagination. Now, CompleteYourSets.com continues, 65, 68, and 62 are miles ahead. I absolutely agree with you on 65 and 62, and we'll talk about 68 tops in this podcast. And I wouldn't say 68 is miles ahead, but it certainly had a little more pizzazz to it than 67 tops did. Now, we also have our Flashback Friday editions, and not this past Friday. We had a set that a lot of people liked this past Friday, and that, of course, is 85 Donruss featuring the player turned priest. Yes, Doug Loman, a rated rookie who didn't quite play out well with the Milwaukee Brewers, was a flash-in-the-pan success, and he's moved on to the pastoral life now. So if you haven't had a chance to listen to that, 85 Donruss, one of our older episodes, well, the weekend before, we featured 91 Bowman, which is one of my favorite sets, and as I mentioned in the previous podcast, it's one of those sets that I really don't think it gets the credit that's due because it followed the 89 and 90 sets, which are not very popular. And I think you really need to give a second look to 89 and 90 because Bowman was doing some smart things then, but a lot of people don't want to give it credit because it wasn't Upper Deck or it wasn't some of the premium sets that were starting to emerge at this time. But 91 Bowman was when the Bowman set turned the corner, had better design, better quality, and a bigger crop of rookies. And of course, Bowman has become the set of the rookie card ever since then. So I asked, why doesn't Bowman, 91 Bowman, get the love it deserves? And C&M Collectibles with an outstanding response, because it's cool to chime in with all the other drones and add negativity about junk wax instead of forming a unique opinion. Well, thank you. My opinion is definitely unique. You don't see a lot of people clamoring for 91 Bowman, but if you get the chance to spend a few extra dollars on some quote-unquote junk wax era, and I hate that term, too, because, yes, there is some junk from the late 80s and early 90s in baseball cards, but that was my childhood. You know, there's still a lot of good stuff and good-looking stuff. May not be as valuable as it once was. Check that. Definitely isn't as valuable as it once was, but it's still fun to go looking through some of this stuff. Well, 91 Bowman is one of those sets where if you can put together, a set with it or grab a couple boxes and just rip through them. Again, you're not going to make a ton of money off of whatever you pull out of there, but I think you'll have a lot of fun looking at some of those cards and looking at some of the big impact players. There's a lot of Hall of Fame players in 91 Bowman, be it a rookie card or, you know, a second or third year card of some outstanding players. So definitely give 91 Bowman a second look, and maybe you will have a unique opinion compared to all the drones. Ben Creech with a couple of tweets heading our way here. Working in my classroom to get everything ready for summer. Glad a Wax Ecstatic podcast dropped at the same time. He was referring to our 67 Tops podcast, which came out the same day, helping pass the time. So I'm glad we could entertain you, Ben. And he adds, just listen to the 1987 Tops podcast. just finished piecing it together, not using eBay, packs, shows, dime boxes, and digging favorite set. And Ben, I'm glad that you caught up with that 87 Tops podcast. And as you heard in that podcast, 87 Tops is one of my favorites. I will put it up there as an all-time favorite, especially in my lifetime. It is definitely, if it's not number one off the top of my head, it's definitely one of the top three that I have collected. And as I shared in that podcast, I have a special connection to 87 Tops in that in the summer of 1993, I was starting to earn a little extra money. I was 15 then. I was earning a lot of extra money by mowing my neighbor's yard. And, you know, I was full 100% going forward with my baseball card collecting back then. And often whenever I got the money, I would go straight to the card shop and buy cello boxes of 87 Tops. And I was able to put together, I want to say at least two sets from that summer. And later I would make a third set. And right now I still have a fourth set that I'm putting together that is missing probably 10 or 15 cards. And I just haven't had the time to really sort it out and put it together. If I did, I could probably finish that and my 89 and or 90 and 91 top sets that are partially completed. I could probably do it all in one weekend, but you know, you got two young kids, it's kind of hard to do that stuff. But 87 Tops, one of my absolute favorites to not only look at and discuss, but to also put together. So I'm glad we could entertain you, and I'm glad you got entertained with one of the best sets in the history of baseball cards. And finally, Gas House Gang recently followed us on not only Twitter, but also listened to our podcast, says, just found the podcast, love it. Newly back into collecting, where is a good place to start? There's so much product now. And that is a dilemma that I went through probably about 3-4 years ago when I came back into the hobby. And if you don't know the story, my son, who is 7.5 years old, I tried to introduce him to baseball cards just to see if he liked it, because he likes all sports and he loves baseball. And when he was about 4.5, the Topps Heritage set that came out was the 2014 set. So that was the 1965 Topps template. And as I mentioned before, 65 Topps, one of my favorite sets. And, you know, I bought a couple of packs, got him into it. And then I started buying a couple for me. And then I started buying the new product. And it's so easy to get inundated. It really is. And in fact, I caught myself last year, you know, just going a little overboard. I'll be honest, going a little overboard. And every time some new product came out, I would buy a few packs just to sample it. And if there was one that I liked, I kept buying a few more. But, you know, by the end of the year, because I, you know, like I said, I've got two young kids, I don't have time to really sit and organize this stuff. Well, I was had a rainy Sunday afternoon or something at the end of the baseball season. I went, you know, I got to just go through this stacks of cards here, and I need to put them in boxes and organize them. So I spent a couple hours doing that, and I look at the boxes and boxes of cards. And remember, this is, you know, probably about 15 years after I purged a lot of my junk wax era cards. And my wife is so patient, letting me get involved with this once again. I kind of went, you know what, Matt, you gotta dial it back here a little bit. You can't just buy one of everything. So, you know, it's not just because I don't want to add boxes and boxes of cards again, but again, with two young kids, you don't want to spend all your money on that. You do need to feed them. So to answer your question, Gas House Gang, in a very long and winding way, I would suggest finding something that you like. So in your case, you probably should sample everything. And this is the time of the year where especially Topps has a lot of products out there. You've got the base set. And in fact, I think Series 2 is coming out pretty soon. You've got the Heritage set. You've got the Archives set. You've got Opening Day set. You've got Bowman, which Topps owns. And then you have other sets that I don't pay much attention to, but other people do. You've got the Panini sets, Panini, you know, resuscitating the Donruss brand a few years ago. But that is not officially licensed by the Players Association. So, You have the logo-free and nickname-free cards, which I'm not a big fan of. And then, you know, you've got other things that you can collect, like wacky packs and stuff like that. So I would actually say go out and buy a couple of packs of each. Open them up. See what you like. See what you don't like. And once you find something that you like, collect it and try to build a set. Try to get some of the, you know, the insert cards or the special edition cards that are thrown in. There are plenty of them these days. But my word of caution, once you find something that you like and collect it, two words of caution, actually. First, stick mostly to that set. Like I said, you can get completely inundated buying pack after pack and box after box of all of these sets here. And then you end up where I was last year, where you have a couple thousand cards just stacked up and you don't know what to do with them. So once you find one, pretty much make that your main focal point. But also, depending on your financial situation, don't go overboard. It is so tempting to, every time you're in Walmart or Target especially, or if you have a local card shop, it is so easy to just go out and splurge. And then all of a sudden you're like, holy crap, I've got $80 worth of wax packs here. It's happened to everybody. If you're listening to me, you're going, yep, happened to me last week. So set a budget. Or set, set some limits to it. For example, what I did, so I didn't go overboard, but I still get to enjoy the collecting process. I've said I'm only going to buy product every 2 weeks, basically the Friday of payday or the weekend of payday. And that is an excuse for me to go out and buy $80 at once. I actually kind of set a limit of $20. So that is either $20 of new stuff, and for me, it's Topps Heritage. I love the Heritage set, so I'll go out and do that. Or, especially because I've gotten back into the vintage cards, especially through this podcast, I have found a local card shop, and the guy's got a couple monster boxes of 1950s and 60s and 70s Topps cards that he bought from the guy a while back. And I can get a pretty decent amount of cards for $20. So that's my advice to you. Find something that you like. Find a product that you like. Try to focus solely on that one. You know, experience a little bit of the others, but don't go overboard. And then once you find that product or two that you like, set some boundaries. You know, okay, I'm only going to spend this many dollars on a pack or a box or a set, whatever the case is, or I'm only going to buy this every other week, once a week, whatever. Treat it like a treat. You know, just like, you know, you get the extra large Frappuccino at Starbucks. You go out to eat, you know, hey, this is the one night a week where we take the family out to, you know, wherever you go, and you splurge a little. It's a little treat. That's kind of how you have to treat this too. So wish you luck. Let us know which direction you go in. And I'd be curious to see which way you go, because I'm sure a lot of our collectors have had the same dilemma. All right, we've had a lot of conversations here. Again, Wax and Gum Stains is the Twitter feed. You can also catch all new episodes of Wax Ecstatic every Tuesday morning. We release it at 10 o'clock Eastern Time, and we release it via Audio Boom, also iTunes, iHeartRadio, Stitcher, and TuneIn. Please make sure, if you're hearing my voice and you want to share this podcast with other people, first send out the Twitter feed at Wax and Gum Stains, and then let them know the new episodes drop on Tuesday mornings. And on Fridays, we have our Flashback Friday edition, a chance for you to listen to some of our older episodes and do a deep dive into the junk wax era. Again, it's a term that I hate, but you know, that's just what people call it. So we'll roll with it for now. All right, let's roll right into 68 Topps, a set that, again, is not one of the best sets that Topps put out there, but it is very memorable for a number of reasons. And in fact, I have a personal historical connection to this set, and I'll share that story in just a little bit. But the 68 Topps set, 598 cards, best known as the burlap set, because the design, for some strange reason, Topps decided to base the design on basically a burlap sack. And young people don't really know what burlap is anymore because we've grown up in the age of little plastic bags at the grocery store or the reusable bags, which are mostly cloth. But burlap, the best way to remind you what burlap is if you've ever been to a company picnic or a school physical education competition day, the potato sack races. I don't even know if they do that anymore, but if you've ever taken part in the potato sack race, potatoes used to be, I don't know if they still are, but used to be packaged in giant burlap sacks. It's this unique weaving of thread and cotton that form the sack. So you have this kind of scratchy brown cover to the baseball cards. And as opposed to what you saw in especially the 66 and 67 sets and what you would see in 1969, where much of the design is left to the photograph, the burlap design really dominates the front of these cards. In fact, a pretty noticeable portion of the card, the border, is dedicated to this bizarre little burlap design. So some collectors don't like it because they think it's tacky, they think it takes up too much space, and I can certainly understand that argument. But it is very unique. For whatever reason, Topps went down the burlap path in 1968, you know as soon as you see one of these cards, that's from 1968. And what's also unique is as the series of cards were released, the burlap design actually changed a little bit. I believe it's the earlier sets, the brown dots that made up the burlap stitching appearance were a little closer, while some of the later sets, the stitching design was a little further apart. So you don't really have one steady look to all these cards in the 68 set. It varies from card to card, and that's a very unique thing. I don't know exactly why Topps went out of their way to do that, but that's just how it happened. Now, 598 cards, two major rookie cards anchor this set. Nolan Ryan, featured alongside future Mets teammate Jerry Kuzman, is the big one from that set. But following very close behind is the Johnny Bench rookie card. And these are worth, depending on the condition, upwards of $1,000, in some cases more, depending, again, on condition and where you get them at. But those have always anchored this set. And, of course, you have second-year cards and third-year and fourth-year cards of some of the biggest stars from this time. Of course, Rod Carew, Steve Carlton, just to name a couple. Basically, any of the big rookie cards from the previous few years, Pete Rose as well, they stand out in this set. Also, the Mickey Mantle card stands out in this set. It is not his last Topps card. He would have one in 1969. In many ways, it is his retirement card, if you will. So you have some outstanding rookies, some pretty good young stars as well as veteran stars. You know, I mentioned Mantle, but you also had guys like Willie Mays in this set. Some, you know, other players from the late 50s and early 60s, Hank Aaron as well, that stood out. Bob Gibson, who had a phenomenal 1968 season, was your Cy Young Award winner and National League MVP that year. And also Denny McClain, the 30-game winner for the world champion Detroit Tigers in 1968. His card certainly garners a little more attention than just your average common card, even though Denny McClain would flame out over the next few years and get himself into a lot of trouble. Side note, my parents were actually ripped off by a Denny McClain real estate scam back in the 70s. So I have no soft spot for that son of a bitch. But anyways, that card stands out. He was the last 30-game winner. And with how pitchers are utilized these days, you're not going to get any more 30-game winners. In fact, the 20-game winner is going to be a pretty rare breed as time goes on. But those are some of the standout cards. Also of note in this set, there are some variations with the color of the team name. There are some white letter cards where the team name was originally in yellow letters. So you have some short print cards that are out there that are basically common players, but because they were variations that were very quickly corrected by the Topps company, they are a little more valuable than the uncorrected, or excuse me, not the uncorrected error, the corrected error. So the white letter version is worth more than the yellow letter version. But some outstanding stars, and again, a very unique design here, not only the burlap sack, but you had the little, I call it the garage sale sticker, which was featured not only in 1968, but you saw it in 1969. Inside the sticker, you have the team name and the position of the player. Meanwhile, in the lower left-hand corner, you would have the player's name. First name in black letters, last name in red letters, all in capital letters. And a lot of the photographs, very similar to much of the 1960s top sets, pose shots, often from spring training. And it's actually funny. I've gone through a lot of 60s cards that I recently bought. And you can see how from one year to another, Topps basically used the same photograph. They just cropped it a little differently. In fact, I might share this on Wax and Gum Stains this week. I bought a lot of cards, a lot of about 80 cards from the 1960s. And I have a 63 Topps and 64 Topps Tommy Davis with the LA Dodgers. And it's the exact same picture. It's just in 64, they cropped it a little tighter than in 63. So, you know, nothing, you know, in terms of a work of art in a lot of these photographs here, but a top standard by this point in time. So the 68 top set stands out for better, for worse in the eyes of collectors because of the burlap sack border that does take up a lot of the card here. I'd say probably about 20% of the card is taken up by this border and the giant garage sale price sticker identifying the player's position and team. And like I said, you would see that sticker show up again in the 1969 set. Now, even though the burlap sack border takes up a lot of the design, I still like it because there's a little bit, if you squint, it looks a little bit like the 55 Bowman TV design. But I would actually think the more appropriate comparison would be to the viewfinder. See if anybody remembers those. Remember the viewfinder where you drop the little disc in on the top and you would pull the little lever down on the side? And the viewfinder was designed to where you had two pictures, and the way the human eye and the mind work, you know, these two pictures would overlap and kind of give you this 3D look. This actually looks like a viewfinder picture, you know, the little square that was featured inside that disc. So again, you know, childhood toy stuff here, it's kind of neat how that works. Now, one of the other positives to the 68 top set is the back is a whole lot easier to look at than the 67 set. So as we flip over this Ed Brinkman card, you will see once again, Topps going with the vertical approach. This is something that I believe 68 was the last year that they would do it, as they went back to the vertical approach, or the horizontal approach, excuse me, throughout the 70s. I take that back. 1973, they went back to vertical. But for much of the future, Topps stuck with the horizontal presentation. So this is one of the last times that you saw the vertical presentation. You've got the card number in the upper left-hand corner, the player's name along the top, personal information inside that little text box at the top. At the bottom, if space permitted, you have either a unique factoid about the player, or in this case, a trivia Q&A. You have the complete major and minor league batting record, or pitching record if it's a pitcher, at the bottom. And again, if space permitted, you had some narrative about the player. And one of the interesting things that you'll see on the back of this card, which we'll talk about with Ed Brinkman, was he was actually a pitcher during his high school days. I mean, he was multifaceted. He played several positions, but actually went 15-1 in 1 year in high school and hurled a perfect game. And again, one of his teammates was the legendary Pete Rose. So we'll get into more details about that. But some pretty interesting notes on the backs of these cards here. And with the gold background, the card did show some wear and tear, but not to the extent of the dark green, the avocado green background that you saw in the 67 top. So Even if collectors aren't thrilled about the design on the front, they like the color scheme on the back because the car could be a little more beat up, but it didn't show it as much as the 67 set did. Now, as for the historical connection here, and this is one of the neat things about baseball cards, and not just cards from the 60s. I mean, you can do cards from the 80s or the 90s, you know, the junk wax era. And one of the fun things about searching through some of these old cards, especially when you were a kid, if you collected big time in the late 80s and early 90s, even though some collectors, actually a lot of collectors, scoff at that era as the junk wax era, you still have an emotional tie to it. It's because that's what you collected as a kid. So you like it. You enjoy it more. You have lots of fond memories about collecting one set over another. Well, 1968, as I mentioned at the beginning of this podcast, it was a year where the United States was coming apart at the seams. Sound familiar? So, 1968, with all the storylines that come out of that, you've got LBJ not running for re-election. You've got the 1968 election with Richard Nixon, and then you have the violence around the Democratic convention in Chicago. You had the Vietnam War going on at that time. This is the year after the Summer of Love, the year before Woodstock. There have been so many TV shows, movies, books written about 1968. It is a seminal year in the history of America. It was a very trying time that would set the course for the next 48 years. And as it turns out, the last few months we've experienced, you know, we're seeing things getting turned on its head once again. So there's a lot of history with 1968. I am a history buff. I not only like sports, I love reading about history, especially American history. And a couple of summers ago, my off-season reading list, I had a biography on the late Walter Cronkite. Me being a broadcaster and a journalist, I've always respected Uncle Walter, as he was known, the head of the CBS Evening News for, 18 years. Even Lyndon Johnson said it in 1968 when Cronkite said that, you know, America can't win the Vietnam War. This is after the Tet Offensive. And, Johnson said, well, if I've lost Walter Cronkite, I've lost America, which was very true. So there's a whole lot going on in 1968. And Walter Cronkite is in the middle of it because he's the one that's reporting it to America. You know, this is before the 24/7 news clock, before CNN and MSNBC and Fox News and headline news and all that stuff, before the internet. You know, you had three sources of news on television. It was ABC, CBS, and NBC. And Cronkite was the most trusted, you know, not that NBC or ABC had shoddy news departments, but Cronkite and CBS News, they were the gold standard at that time. So a couple summers ago, I'm reading his biography, and it just happens, this is just pure chance, I order a lot of cards. In fact, I won it in an auction. It wasn't a buy it now. It was an auction on eBay. A lot of, I think it was like 30, 68 Topps cards. And true to my standards, I didn't care what condition they were in. They were actually in pretty darn good condition. They weren't as beat up as some of the other cards you've seen on this podcast recently. But I remember going through these cards, and it just happened to be right after I read the 1968 chapter in this biography of Walter Cronkite when I received these cards. So one night, I'm just kind of looking through them, and this is where history is in my hands. And I'm looking at these cards, and they're mostly common players. And, you know, they're mostly in excellent to near mint condition. And I'm just kind of looking through these, and I go, wow. So when America was coming apart at the seams in 1968, somebody, probably, a young boy who is not as concerned about what's going on around the world as his parents are, is thumbing through these cards like I am. And it was just so neat, you know, after reading about 1968 and, you know, how Cronkite dealt with everything, holding these cards from 1968. And, you know, then it's not just, well, I'm holding it, then, you know, I'm reading the cards, I'm smelling them. You know, there's a very unique smell to the old wax cards, like I've said before, but especially the white cardstock, there's almost a business card smell to it, but it, you know, kind of a, I don't want to say a mothball, but there is a little bit of a musty smell to it. So I'm looking at them. I'm paying a close attention to them and I'm smelling them. I know it sounds weird, but you know, there is a unique smell to these cards. And, you know, it kind of dawned on me. I'm like, wow, I'm holding history here. You know, we can look back at 1968 and go, whoo, boy, the wheels were coming off then. But somebody was thumbing through these cards in 1968 and getting some joy out of it, at least a distraction from all the other nonsense that was going on in the world back then. And the sport of baseball was doing much the same. You know, I mentioned Denny McClain and Bob Gibson, who were both MVPs for their respective leagues. You had that epic World Series, 7-game series between the defending champion Cardinals and the soon-to-be champion Tigers. There have been books written about the 1968 Major League Baseball season because it was a convenient, entertaining distraction to all the other crap that was going on in the world. And I can tell you, folks, we're living through it right now. Yeah, it was neat to see the Cubs win the World Series last year, but you know why a lot of people wanted to watch that World Series? Not only to see if the Cubs could win, but because they wanted to just put all the other crap behind them. This was just a couple weeks before the election. And I think given all the crap we're dealing with now, a lot of people are turning to, as my late great friend Chris Thomas would say, the opiate of the masses, sports, to escape from it. So this is why people are so clued into, the baseball season, even though we're midway through it. This is why people are so clued into the NHL and NBA finals right now, because they get to, even if you're not a fan of the teams involved in those championship rounds, you get to just forget about this nonsense that's going on in this world for a couple of hours. You know, 1968, very interesting year historically, not just for baseball, but nationally, and the chance to hold some of these pieces of history in my hand, even though they were common players. It was just a neat experience for me, and I absolutely loved doing it. I still do to this day, and that's part of the reason why I've bought a lot of the Heritage cards from this year, not only because that is my dedicated set, you know, getting back into what should I buy if I'm getting into this hobby again. Not only is the Heritage set my cup of tea, you know, they've really replicated the 68 set well. So, you know, it's a lot of fun diving into some of these older sets here, and especially 68, because not only is it a neat and unique design, not only do you have some really powerful rookies that anchor this set and some really good young stars and some veteran stars as well, but it comes from a time when a lot of people probably felt that things could not be improved upon. And that things were going to hell in a handbasket. Again, sound familiar? We're feeling that exact same feeling today. So you get some joy opening up a pack now and seeing what's in it, much like people did in 1968. So it's funny how things come full circle again nearly 50 years later. And 68 Tops was a very nice distraction for a lot of people, and it was a pretty good set to distract them with. Now, as for our random poll card number 49, Ed Brinkman, who had a very serviceable career. He was actually a top shortstop in Major League Baseball for the very lengthy career that he had. As I said, 15 seasons, although it was a struggle down the end, but he was an all-star and a gold glove winner, not known for his bat, although one Teddy ball game, Ted Williams, was able to help him out with that. But he was born the day after the Pearl Harbor attack, December 8th, 1941, and he was a fast rising star in Cincinnati, Ohio. In fact, he played for Western Hills High School in the late 1950s, was a teammate with Pete Rose. As we mentioned on the back of the card, he was a winner of 15 games, had a perfect game in his senior year. He also batted 460. So you look at 460, you look at a 15-1 pitcher, he's got a perfect game, he's going to get some attention. And he got enough attention to where he signed a $75,000 bonus with the Washington Senators in 1959. Now, that is the first Washington Senators. However, he was able to re-sign with the new Washington Senators in 1961 as an amateur free agent. So he is one of the few, I'd have to see, he might be the only, but he is one of the few players who you could say was a member of the first Washington Senators and the second Washington Senators. But he signs in 1961 as an amateur free agent, makes his major league debut at the age of 19 late in the 1961 season, and again was not really known for his batting average, but had a very steady glove at the shortstop position. Now, he went back and forth between Washington and the minor leagues for a couple seasons, became a regular in 1963. His batting average was in the low 200s, however. That would change in 1969 when new Washington owner Bob Short wanted to make a big splash with a team that was just floundering around for years. So he hires Ted Williams as the manager, and we discussed this in the 1963 Topps podcast with Frank Howard. Williams was able to get Howard to actually take a few pitches. Howard would still hit 30 or 40 home runs, but he got on base more. He cut down his strikeouts tremendously. He got a lot more walks than he used to. So Ted Williams not only helped a power hitter like Frank Howard, he could also help a slap hitter like Ed Brinkman. So Brinkman in 1968, now he only played in 77 games, but he had a 187 batting average. Well, with a little bit of help from Ted Williams, he ups that average quite considerably to 266. Of course, he also played 151 games, so that helped his cause out there. And he was able to continue his hot hitting, so to speak, under the tutelage of Williams in 1970 when he hit 262 while playing in 158 games. Brinkman was also part of a very lopsided deal that the Senators made. The Senators made a lot of them, even though they were able to bring up some pretty good young talent in the mid-60s. They squandered it away. The second edition of the Washington Senators just couldn't figure things out. People forget the first edition of the Washington Senators, along with the Yankees and the Philadelphia Athletics, they were actually the cream of the crop in the American League in the late 20s and early 30s. But, you know, Washington, as the old joke would go, first in war, first in peace, last in the American League, they really struggled. And it's because of deals like this. After the 1970 season, Brinkman, along with Joe Coleman, Jim Hannon, and Aurelio Rodriguez, were traded to Detroit for Elliot Maddox, Denny McClain, Norm McRae, and Don Wirt. Now, we talked about McClain. He was going down the chute by this point in time. Norm McRae, Don Wirt, serviceable players. Elliot Maddox, a very moody, misunderstood player, didn't really succeed until about 7 or 8 years later with the Yankees. But it wasn't a deal that immediately helped the Senators. It did, however, help the Detroit Tigers. And speaking of Billy Martin, who would become the manager of the Tigers at this time, Martin absolutely loved Brinkman because he was so solid at shortstop. And along with Rodriguez, there was nothing getting past both of those guys on the left side of the infield. So the acquisition of Brinkman going into the 1971 season really helped the Tigers kind of revive their fortunes, because after winning the World Series in 68, they slipped down for a couple of years. They were able to make it to the division playoffs in 1972, nearly beat Oakland. Of course, the A's starting the first of three consecutive World Series championships. Well, they almost topped the A's in 1972. And 72 was a banner year for Brinkman. He was a Gold Glove winner. He was actually in the MVP race in the American League, finished ninth in voting. And you could say that he bested it in 1973 as an All-Star representative at the age of 31 for the Tigers, his only All-Star appearance. He appeared in all 162 games for the Tigers, also appeared in all 156 games for the Tigers the previous season. So this guy was an Iron Man, very dependable. That is until just after 1974. He started experiencing back problems. In fact, he had a ruptured disc in 1972, so that limited his playoff time in that series against Oakland. Certainly didn't help the Tigers' cause then. Well, the back problems started mounting over and over and over again, and that would very quickly, unfortunately, end his playing career. After the 74 season, traded from Detroit to San Diego for Nate Colbert. On that same day, the Padres would then flip him to St. Louis. Now, he would play a very short time for the St. Louis Cardinals. In fact, appeared in only 28 games officially that season. In June of 75, traded to the Texas Rangers, where Billy Martin was still the manager, although he was on his way out. But his time in Texas, Brinkman, that is, was also very short. In fact, he only appeared in one game before the New York Yankees acquired him. Of course, Billy Martin would eventually go on to the Yankees shortly thereafter, but the time in New York was short for Brinkman, as the back injuries just would not let up, and he only appeared in 44 games, and the Yankees released him just prior to the 1976 season, and that was it for Brinkman's career. 15 years, 1,845 games, again, not really known for his batting average, a .224 career hitter, but best known for his fielding prowess. He was very dependable in the infield. As I've mentioned, a Gold Glove winner, an All-Star as well. Now, he did have his fair share of errors throughout his career, but this was a guy who was still overall pretty dependable and shored up the left side of the infield, specifically for Detroit, but for many years in anonymity in Washington with the expansion Senators, who, of course, would move on to Texas prior to the 1972 season. Now, after his playing career, he became a coach. He was part of the Tigers organization for many, many years, managed the Montgomery Rebels in the late 1970s. He was also a coach and a scout with the Chicago White Sox for a long time, 18 years, and he was also an infield coach in the mid-1980s for the White Sox. He passed away at the age of 66 in September of 2008 from complications of heart failure. And one other interesting note of Ed Brinkman, his younger brother, Chuck Brinkman, also made it to the major leagues. He played for a short time in the early 1970s, late 60s, early 70s. He was a catcher for the Chicago White Sox and later the Pittsburgh Pirates. So it's kind of funny, Ed and Chuck Brinkman making it to the major leagues one podcast after we had Boog Powell and his stepbrother Carl Taylor making it to the big leagues, while one of Boog's brothers made it in professional baseball, just not up to the major league level. So a couple of podcasts back to back about family members sharing time in the major leagues. So that's kind of neat. So even though Ed Brinkman was no Pete Rose, he was highly sought after, and while Pete Rose certainly had a much more phenomenal career than Ed Brinkman, Ed Brinkman is one of those players who really had a serviceable career, was able to provide some solid, dependable defense for a few teams in his 15 years in the big leagues, and he was also able to learn some of the tricks of the trade of hitting the ball a little better under the great Ted Williams, and may he rest in peace, again passing away back in 2008. Ed Brinkman, our random pull, card number 49 from the 68 Topps set. Like many of these other vintage sets, I do advise that if you want to get your hands on some of them, start out with a local card shop, see if they have any boxes of common cards just sitting in the background. You could probably pick up lots of 20 or 30 cards for $15, $20, depending on the condition. And you can also look on eBay or other auction sites. You will find some dealers that, again, have lots of 20 or 30 cards that you could probably get for around $20 or $30, depending on the shipping method. And again, don't worry too much about the condition of these cards. Don't worry about the names of the players. You know, if you can get a star card or a big rookie card for a good deal, absolutely, go ahead and get it. But it's really neat. Again, holding pieces of history, and especially from 1968, a year that, you know, we're kind of reliving in many ways now, but a year where so much seemed to be wrong and falling apart and just becoming unraveled. But one thing that helped people get through that time, and something that has stood the test of time, baseball and baseball cards. It's really neat to hold these pieces of history, and especially such a unique design. As ridiculed as the burlap design is, it's very unique. And overall, I think 68 Topps is a very fun set to collect if you can get your hands on some of these cards. Even if there are lots of common cards, it's neat to kind of thumb through these and look back at some of the players and some of the teams and some of the interesting stats and trivial tidbits that you find on the back. All right, we go from 1968 to the summer of 69. I will spare you the Bryan Adams songs and also the sore neck jokes of the summer of 69. But it was another big year for Topps because it was another big year for baseball, expanding by four teams. Why in the world would they do that? Well, you can blame Charlie Finley mostly. We'll explain that. We'll do a random pull, and we'll take a look at a set that has grown on me a little bit, but it's still one of those sets that's lacking. This is part of Topps' dry era, mid to late 60s going into the early 70s. Things would liven up starting in 1971, but in 1969, thanks in part to the expansion, Topps had to play it safe again. But this time around, as opposed to 61 Topps, they did some things really well that make the 69 Topps set stand out. So that's coming your way next Tuesday morning, 10 o'clock Eastern. We'll release that. We've also got our Flashback Friday episode, so keep an eye out for that. Also, follow us at Wax and Gum Stains. Look out for the auction item, which we will put up for bids, the 81 Topps rack pack, the store pack. We will put up, if not this week, then next week. And if you're interested in bidding in that, we will do the video break of that set at some point in time. And as always, spread the word about Wax and Gum Stains to your collecting friends, and also let them know that all episodes, new and archived, can be heard on Audioboom, iTunes, iHeartRadio, TuneIn, and Stitcher. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. Thank you so much again for joining us for another episode of Wax Ecstatic. We'll see you next week.